We know from history that Winston Churchill tried almost alone there for a while to resist German rearmament prior to World War II. When Neville Chamberlain conceded Czechoslovakia to Hitler and promised peace for our time, Churchill knew that Hitler wanted more. Likewise in America, Franklin Delano Roosevelt resisted isolationism and fought the idea that Hitler was just a European problem. What's not so well known, though, is that FDR drew upon five quite extraordinary men to help him with the task of bringing America into the war. They succeeded, and world history changed because of it. Their story is now told in detail by an Australian, Michael Fullilove, who's the head of the Lowy Institute for International Policy, has written Rendezvous with Destiny, How Franklin D. Roosevelt and Five Extraordinary Men Took America into the War and into the World. Michael Fullilove, welcome to Breakfast.
Thanks, Fran.
Before we get to these five men who really are interesting, each and every one of them, let's explain the context. What was the significance of US isolationism before and at the beginning of World War II?
Well, in September 1939, when Germany invaded Poland, Hitler was obviously a clear and present danger to the world, except including the United States, and yet only one in 40 Americans favoured a US declaration of war against Germany. I mean, basically, shielded by great oceans to the east and the west, and with pliant neighbours to the north and the south, the Americans did not want to get involved in the war, and this is what Roosevelt faced. He was an internationalist by instinct. He defined America's interests globally, but he faced public anxiety and congressional opposition, as well as unreliable partners abroad. And he had to bring America along. He had to bring his country with him on this very difficult journey from a nervous, isolationist middle power into a great power that was actively involved in this conflict. This is the journey that I try to describe in the book.
He also faced some pressure from Winston Churchill, because as FDR knew, as did Churchill, the US isolationism needed to end if Hitler's ambition for Europe were to be defeated. I mean, Churchill knew he needed America.
For Churchill, American entry into the war was an existential question. Churchill knew that the British Empire could not defeat the Nazis by themselves. So bringing America into the conflict became the alpha and omega of British foreign policy.
Is it fair to say that FDR wasn't always all the way with Churchill? When Neville Chamberlain came back from Munich with a peace deal at the expense of Czechoslovakia, Roosevelt sent him a two-word telegram, good man.
I think it's true to say that Roosevelt's views developed on the issue, and historians have a big argument about whether he really wanted to take America into the war, but The journey that I sketch is that with each development in Europe, with each reversal in Europe, as events got more serious, FDR's policy hardened. And over this period, it got harder and harder and harder. And he used these envoys to demonstrate to the American people how significant and how much their interests were engaged in this war.
Let's go to the envoys. He corralled this mix of five men. Harry Hopkins, let's start with him. Essentially, we'd probably call him a fixer today, a political fixer for the president. He helped set up the New Deal. What was his role in this?
Well, Hopkins is actually like a great old-fashioned Sydney character in a way, because he, you know, loved the ponies, loved the racetrack. He sympathised.
A colourful character.
He was a colourful Sydney character. He was the son of a saddlemaker from Sioux City, Iowa. He loved to run with the thoroughbreds, but he was on the side of the underdogs. He was a New Dealer. He lived in the White House for most of the Second World War, and he became the great confidant of both Churchill's and Stalin's. Quite a remarkable figure.
And you write about a speech that he made. He got sent to England.
Yeah.
He was there for a long time, which I'm also struck by in this book. The pace of diplomatic niceties was quite slow back then. He was in England for quite a while. He gave this speech while he was there, less than a minute long, but it brought Churchill to tears. Tell us about that.
Well, this was at a time when the bombs were raining down on London, and Churchill was desperate to know what Roosevelt was going to do. And he had a private dinner for Hopkins, Roosevelt's envoy, and he asked Hopkins to speak. And Hopkins was a frail character. His face was white and drawn, and he stood up and he leaned on the back of his chair. He said, "Mr. Chairman, I'm not making speeches over here. I'm reporting what I see to Mr. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, my president." He said, "But now that I'm here and I'm on my feet, perhaps I might say in the language of the old book," and here he paused and he looked right down the table at Churchill, "Whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God, even unto the end." And tears were streaming down Churchill's face, and one of Churchill's advisers said, "All of us knew what it meant. Even to us, it sounded like a rope that was thrown to a drowning man."
It was a promise.
It was a very subtle signal to Churchill that Roosevelt was with him.
And it's interesting, though, that this man had been basically hanging out with Churchill for a few weeks, that the promises and the pledges were still being made that subtly.
Because Roosevelt was playing this very difficult game. I mean, he'd only just won re-election. Most of the Republican Party was dyed-in-the-wool isolationists. Most of the public were dead against deepening involvement. And so Roosevelt had to bring them along in a subtle kind of way.
Tell us about one of the other five, Wendell Willkie. He was the Republican that Roosevelt had just defeated in the presidential election, and then he ropes him in.
Willkie is one of the great forgotten figures of American life. He was a registered Democrat his whole life. He became a Republican at the last minute. Quite just by public acclaim, became the Republican nominee for president. He was this big, broad-shouldered, broad-minded internationalist Republican, and he ran against the rest of his party in advocating greater American intervention. And after he lost to Roosevelt in November 1940, he announced he was going to England, and Roosevelt brought him to the White House and gave him a magnificent letter to hand to Winston Churchill. And in giving him that letter, which quoted Longfellow and was a very dramatic and emotional letter, he really transformed Willkie almost into an instrument of his own diplomacy.
Which was his plan, the way you write it. He had designs for Willkie that Willkie didn't particularly want to be a part of. I mean, this guy just knocked him off in the presidential election. He didn't want to really seem to be an instrument of the president.
No, exactly. Roosevelt wanted to use him to boost British morale, to win over wary Americans to the cause, in particular to wedge the isolationist Republicans by sort of boosting the internationalist Republican. But Roosevelt was also a master politician, and he also wanted to demonstrate his mastery over the scene by using his opponent as a messenger boy, and Willkie didn't like that. And Willkie kept protesting that, you know, I'm not really an envoy, but he was seen as one.
And the letter he carried, the Ship of State letter,
yes.
I mean, when you read it, which you will now, I hope.
Yeah. So Roosevelt had Willkie in the day before he was inaugurated, and he took a piece of stationery and he wrote this: "Dear Churchill, Wendell Willkie will give you this. He is truly helping to keep politics out over here. I think this verse applies to your people as it does to us. Sail on, O ship of state. Sail on, O Union strong and great. Humanity, with all its fears, with all the hopes of future years, is hanging breathless on thy fate. As ever yours, Franklin D. Roosevelt." And his speechwriter said afterwards, "We had no idea where this came from. He never talked about it beforehand. It was the kind of gesture that Roosevelt had a genius for, and it became this sort of wonderful symbol of the Roosevelt-Churchill relationship."
It's 21 past 8 on Breakfast. Our guest this morning is Michael Fullilove. He's written a book called Rendezvous with Destiny, How Franklin D. Roosevelt and Five Extraordinary Men Took America into the War and into the World. We've talked about two of them. Let's go to the others. Sumner Wells, a well-bred diplomat whose highbrow society family held high positions in U.S. society going right back to the 1600s.
And he was the only career diplomat of the lot, and he was immaculate in dress and very buttoned down. But he was also a tragic figure. He was eventually railroaded out of the State Department for making homosexual advances to African-American railroad porters on the president's train. And he was ruined by his enemies, who were jealous of his intimacy with Roosevelt because of this misdemeanor.
And he had an important role. He met with Hitler. He met with Mussolini.
He did, yeah. So this was
the Pope?
Exactly. He undertook a tour of Europe when Roosevelt was still clutching for a policy, I guess, before his policy hardened later in the book.
What about Wild Bill Donovan?
Wild Bill Donovan was a war hero from the First World War, a lawyer, a Republican adventurer, and he later became the spy master who established the OSS, which was the forerunner of the CIA. If you go to CIA headquarters at Langley, Fran, you'll see a bronze statue of Wild Bill Donovan.
And but he was not that at this point.
He wasn't. No, the book describes his first emergence onto the world stage, and he went to London immediately after the fall of France. And Roosevelt was basically being advised by Joe Kennedy, who was a great appeaser and isolationist, that Roosevelt shouldn't bet on Britain. Mm. And while Bill Donovan came back and said, "Mr. President, Kennedy's wrong, you should bet on them."
And then he drags in a businessman, the railroad tycoon Avril Harriman, Roosevelt's ambassador to the Soviet Union. Tell us about him, Harriman.
Harriman was a railroad heir and a banker. He was an incredibly handsome man, humourless, grim, very popular with women, and Roosevelt sent him to London to manage the Lend-Lease program of aid from London. And while he was there, he romanced Pamela Churchill, who was Winston's daughter-in-law. And many decades later, when their respective partners had died, Averill and Pamela married, and she became Pamela Harriman, the grand dame of Democratic politics. And Bill Clinton appointed her his ambassador to France. And Pamela Harriman, in one of these lovely sort of closed historical circles, Pamela Harriman died while swimming laps at the Ritz, which was Sumner Wells's hotel in Paris when he was on mission.
It's all about the five. As important as these five were, Michael, wasn't it Japan that sealed the fate of the isolationists? I mean, if Pearl Harbor hadn't happened, America might not have entered the war. Is that fair to say?
Well, I disagree with that. I mean, some historians would say that. But I think if you look at the pattern of Roosevelt's policy over these 2 years, which is the story I'm trying to tell, it's one of constant hardening. And I think I think Roosevelt would have declared war sooner or later. But the way it happened, I mean, for Japan to declare war on the United States meant that America entered the war united, rather than divided.
Do you think Roosevelt would have entered the war if he'd been relying on the advice of the State Department if he hadn't had these five men?
Look, in the end, I think leaders make these decisions, and Roosevelt's the one character we haven't spoken of, and he sort of looms over the rest of the characters. So I think he knew his own mind, but I think it's also true that these individuals played critical roles at important moments. Donovan, after the fall of France, as I mentioned, but Hopkins also, after the invasion of Russia, Roosevelt sent Hopkins back to Moscow. He was the first foreigner to meet with Stalin after Operation Barbarossa. And he sent a positive report back to Washington about Russia's chances of withstanding the German invasion. So I think they did play really critical roles.
Just finally, Michael, it's a book of world history. It's for a world audience, and it's a great read. But you've had a good look into the Australian archives. What do they reveal?
Lots of things. I mean, most Northern Hemisphere historians don't bother to come all this way to look at our historians. But because I'm an Australian, I was very alert to Australian references, and Australian characters play cameo roles. Bob Menzies walks in and out of the action. And Richard Casey and Stanley Melbourne Bruce, both Cambridge-educated Australian Tories who were serving as minister in Washington and High Commissioner in London, actually play this really important little role in clearing the communications channel between Roosevelt and Churchill. So there's lots of little Australian readers will see little Australian references sprinkled throughout the text.
And there's one moment that's hard to get out of your mind when Roosevelt walks in on Churchill in the bath.
That's right. Just after Pearl Harbor, Churchill went to Washington and actually stayed with Roosevelt in the family quarters. And Roosevelt came upon him in his bedroom mid-morning in the bath. And he tried to roll his wheelchair out and leave. And Churchill stood up and called him back and said, "Franklin, come back. The Prime Minister of Great Britain has nothing to hide from the President of the United States."
And so the bonds between men are formed. Michael Fullilove, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Fran.
Michael Fullilove is the author of Rendezvous with Destiny, How Franklin D. Roosevelt and Five Extraordinary Men Took America into the War and into the World. It's published by Penguin. And Michael Fullilove, too, is also the head of the Lowy Institute. It's 27 past 8.